Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 18th, 2026. All right, Tom, what do you got for us to kick it off?
I got more of a conversational-driven one, but definitely interesting topic. I know a lot of folks are interested in this, and it's taken some headlines lately, but this is an article pulled from infostealers.com. It's titled Real World Info Stealer Infection Targeting Open Claw Configurations. So Hudson Rock had identified and has now detected a live infection where an info stealer successfully exfiltrated a victim's open claw configuration environment. So it's kind of really marking a new milestone in like what info stealers can be and the behavior of them. Basically not just stealing, you know, general user data or credentials like you would, like, you know, historically we typically cared about, but really being able to gain access to full scope of personal AI agents or the soul of it, as the article references. The openclaw.json file that was one of the specific artifacts acts as a central nervous system for that agent. And in the case referenced in the article, the attacker was actually able to retrieve the victim's information from just that file. Some pretty important information, email address, workspaces, and then the high entropy gateway token. Why does that gateway token matter, you ask? Glad you asked. The gateway token allows an attacker to continue to or to connect to the victim's local OpenClaw instance remotely, especially if the port is exposed, or they can leverage it to impersonate the client in authenticated requests to the AI gateway. Worse, the attackers were also able to steal the device.json file. That file contains the public and private key of the user's device. These keys are used to secure pairing, signing operations within the OpenClaw ecosystem. The article also discusses the idea that modern AI agents like this are more than just scripts or simple software. They're persistent and they grow with use. They kind of have personalities. By accessing, and in this case, stealing some of the other additional files, a couple they called out, soul.md, agents.md, and memory.md. These files provide an attacker basically with a full blueprint for that particular user's life and everything they've used within the agent. The article also demonstrates how the theft of these files can be leveraged. Hudson Rock used its own AI system, Anki, to do a risk assessment and to really show the demonstration of the layers of concern. And what that risk assessment came from that will show that just the files that were able to be stolen from this could provide full account takeover, full swath of reusable secrets, remote access, and more. You know, it's not overwhelming. This article isn't huge, Scott, but I do think it raises an interesting topic. So we start talking about the use of these AI agents and what they do. And I think we've talked about this with a lot of the AI stuff before as we've gone through this ever-evolving subject that, you know, security is not necessarily considered. Some of the things that were able to be accessed so easily here, I guess both surprised me and didn't. I think it's a topic of conversation. And this is something that AI every time there's a new tool, people are running, right? They're running. Now you're taking agents, you're dropping them on your personal devices and you're leveraging them there. Your things are being stored there. Configurations are being managed there. And you just, you know, you're dumping all this stuff into it. And are we considering security at all? Do we understand everything that these agents can access? But I think moreover, above anything, this just shouts to something that we should be thinking about already. If we're not, I always hate that it takes an event or an article like this or something bigger to happen for people to start paying attention to it. But the technology should be considered. And this really does seem to open up a whole swath of potential problems, especially just from this info stealer direction. But I'm curious what you think, man.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of opens up like a whole few different topics, actually. One, when I first heard this, it kind of took me back to, you know, when you think of agentic AI, you're really thinking automation again, right? And if you remember back in the days where you wanted to be able to automate everything, but in order to automate everything, you needed access to everything. And sometimes that access was a little overreaching. And so anyone that you needed access from, especially if someone else owned whatever it was you needed access to, they were very hesitant. Like they didn't want to give up that access because of this type of risk, right? And now you're kind of in the same boat where you're trying to automate a lot of things that you as a person interact with. You don't have the same gatekeepers to kind of give you that, should I be accessing, what's the risk with this? How should I protect this? That perspective, right? So I feel like it's like a similar problem, but just in a different attack surface and maybe a potentially easier target. But like some of the things you called out, there's could potentially be more longer term risks. One, I do think that being able to steal what kind of agents people create, and agents, you know, you kind of educate or specialize in specific things, those specialties and those agents might be able to be leveraged to then get additional information that maybe isn't necessarily called out in the specific agent configs, especially if you're able to impersonate the person that's supposed to be utilizing these agents in their workspace. Because I know even now when I use specific LLMs, it's now I can see where every conversation I have, even new conversations, it constantly is now referencing other conversations that I have had. And I do a pretty good job deleting certain things out, but I'm pretty sure it's definitely referencing the ones that are not deleted from past conversations. So you can imagine how there can be a potential leak of a ton of information if you kind of have that kind of just a little bit of access and time. For one, the API key thing, you know, it's always interesting for me because, if, as long as you know what you're granting access and where those keys are kind of stored, then I do think that knowing how to roll API keys for services and things you have is also a really important thing to have some grasp on, especially if you're going down this path of agentic stuff and stuff that's going to be interacting with different services, just because, you know, rolling an API key, as long as you kind of already know the process and where it's utilized, it's pretty simple, right? You pretty much go retire the old one, get a new one, paste it in whatever it needs to be in, as long as you have like a central way to kind of manage all that. From a personal level, obviously from an operational or organizational level, that could be a little more complicated, but you should have processes for those anyways. That is another way where you can kind of try to protect yourself if you think there's been exposure or those types of things. Because I think that's why a lot of developers are being targeted, because they're technical. They usually tie a bunch of access, even if it's not just information people are after, it could be resources. A lot of times just having access to a cloud environment that you don't need to pay for is enough to leverage for resources from, you know, the coin mining aspect, right? Or even proxying through from a infrastructure perspective. So, you know, there's some really kind of interesting things here. The one thing, it would be interesting if you tried to set up telemetry or defenses for this type of stuff, because obviously with a lot of the LLM type stuff, markdown files, the .mds and JSONs are heavily used, right, as a file type. And then location probably does matter as well as far as where you intend to store these things. You probably have some control over that. Especially if everything's local. So what kind of like file access monitoring can you put onto those, right? I know there's a type of access things, and depending on what you're doing and how often it's accessed, I can't imagine it would be too heavy to try to log that, even if it is a little more verbose than you probably would want. But that might be telling, right? Depending on if you're able to, you know, figure out to partition that up and understand what that looks like, it might not be fruitful. It just kind of depends. But obviously looking for any type of command line telemetry where people are trying to either grab JSON or .md, the markdown files, and any reference I mentioned might be of interest more nowadays, because I'm sure there is going to be different ways people try to get at this information. And if anything, from what we've seen in the past, when it comes to ransomwares, when it comes to info stealers, they do heavily seek out specific file types, specific extensions, specific paths in command lines and things that they do from other executions down the chain. They kind of help you identify there's nefarious activity or even fingerprint the type of activity that's going on. I think that could be heavily beneficial to kind of understand some of these things. And the other thing was, I was just thinking about from like a, how would you fix this problem? And from like an engineering or architectural type place, I just feel like some of this stuff, there's not a lot of data being stored, right, in these JSON or Markdown files, typically, right? They don't get too long because there is like a context limit you never really want to hit, especially with LLMs, to make them effective. And also, so you're not hitting your limits because that's also money. So I feel like if there was some mechanism that kept this stuff encrypted at, you know, and actually every time it was accessed, it did a decryption. It would be such a lightweight ask, right? To decrypt things on the fly, to read certain things in, I would think. Now, granted, maybe you don't have to read the full context files or things when LLMs are accessing them. I don't know. Or maybe it's, you know, stored locally with the LLMs or whatever you're leveraging temporarily. So it just reads it once and then it's there and then just has to write to it at some point to update. I'm not 100% sure on all that, but those are the types of solutions I would think about because encrypting text is so lightweight. Decrypting text is so lightweight. And there's some other types of controls or access that it would be easier to identify than just flat files as being stolen, right? Because this is going to be, I think, now this is kind of out there and people are going to be leveraging this. I can see these types of attacks persisting or being added to the even the common info stealers that we see even today as just additional things to try to grab and look for. If you ever remember in the past, anytime we saw info stealers where they were stealing certain things from browsers, then other browsers type stuff was being added and then other locations for other types of tools and common applications when Discord became a thing were being added, you know. And I just feel like it's one of those things that will just kind of be part of the grab bag at this point, based on some of the value that's there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, considering the momentum, it seems like just with this specific tool, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of taken over. It's a big wave that's happening, right? It's just like, yeah, it just popped, you know, kind of out of nowhere. Now it's like everybody's hearing about it, understanding it. People are using it. But the way that it can integrate with so many different things, so many different chat apps, so many different, all the different LLMs and everything in between, it's a gold mine for an info stealer. So yeah, I don't, you know, I don't know if it's just the technology like always outpaces the education on it or what, because I do think there's simple things you can do to protect yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Even, but it living in your own environment, on your own device, in most cases, is going to be used by individuals, it seems. You know, understanding that these things are out there, just, it's just paramount. And it's kind of crazy because you can almost foreshadow we're going to use these tools to help simplify our lives. That's what we do with technology, yeah. Right?
And it's interesting because like the target set really has moved towards more of the developer tech personality in general. And I really believe a lot of that has to do with the way we've also dispersed all of our tools and resources, you know, like.
Yeah.
Now we have so many SaaS applications we interact with for different solutions because that's how they're offered. It's the only way to have them, right? And so then therefore there's like APIs or integrations you're leveraging that way. There's, you know, all the cloud-based stuff, which depending on what you're using, there's all sorts of different types of access and tokens associated with that. And then, you know, from like an on-prem perspective, there's not that much more on-prem that a lot of attackers would necessarily care about. It's almost like a lot of the value that used to be safeguarded on-prem with all the different levels of security. A lot of the value is moved out of on-prem. So there's still value on-prem, but what attackers see as valuable, I think is shifting. And so therefore the attacks for what they target is different too. So it's also interesting.
Yeah, we're approaching the future, so I hope everyone listening is thinking about it. At least just think about it, right? Consider it before diving in.
Yeah, don't be surprised. That's the biggest thing you don't want, right? Be aware.
Yeah, when somebody that is leveraging it to speed up their life and might be a very, you know, maybe a leader in a certain area or somebody that has a lot to lose ends up getting it lost for these reasons.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what do you got next, Scott?
So next one's going to be kind of in a similar light, because it's something that's also kind of targets developers, and it deals with kind of the AI stuff. Like, we've talked about MCP servers before, and this specific article from Striker AI, it's a blog, and it's titled Smart Loader Clones Aura Ring MCP to Deploy Supply Chain Attack. What their research lab uncovered was a Trojanized MCP server. And we talked about this in the past, but it was basically, cloning the Aura Ring, which people aren't familiar. There's like a smart ring called the Aura Ring that can collect health data, kind of like your smartwatch would do, and kind of popular amongst tech folk. And basically it infiltrated legitimate, MCP registries. Forked off essentially these types of MP servers, were able to build confidence in their forked version by having multiple GitHub accounts, basically developed to be contributors to this fork. So it looks, you know, not like it's just a single entity contributing to whatever this is. And then they were able to successfully poison legitimate MCP registries in the process. I guess this actor previously, they leveraged a lot of SEO poisoning for some of their campaigns to spread info stealers. Kind of probably a similar methodology to try to poison which MCP server is going to be recommended for what to get there to the top. So there was some patience and some building before they kind of dropped this. But so, you know, when they created at least 5 fake GitHub accounts, right? They added fake accounts as contributors. They deliberately excluded the original author from the contributor list, maybe so that they wouldn't see this happen, because they might throw up the red flags initially. So it's, you know, it's those traditional trust signals that they call out, you know, the GitHub stars, the forks, the contributor counts, all those things that usually when you see something on GitHub, because that's where a lot of these things are hosted, it immediately becomes, this is a lot of people follow this. If this was bad, it would have kind of been on our radar essentially. But eventually the payload delivers a steal C info stealer, right? Where it steals all kind of all the stuff we just talked about. Ironically also steals your Aura Ring health data. You know, why not? As part of this batch. And you know, they link this to China. But it's interesting because they talked about the malware in general, and it looks like that there were some Russian ties too, based on some infrastructure. But to say the least, the attack, how it kind of happened, the MPC server was called the Aura MCP server. That was the legitimate one, I believe. And then they created the MCP Aura. Right, similar sounding name, just kind of changed the order of things. And what they would do is, you know, something that's Trojanized means it also has something contained within it. And in the basically cloned MCP server, they had an additional file that was a resources.txt, right? And the resources.txt actually was a LuaJIT script or Lua script. Lua is kind of similar to like a lot of other scripting languages. It's something that doesn't get compiled. It just gets kind of read and interpreted on the fly. Python's similar to this as well. So it's a lot easier for the people to create things in, but it's also easier to get things past sometimes security tools because of that. But essentially, when it was executed, it deploys the runtime environment for Lua into the user app data directories. So we've talked about that being a common place. Creates its own directory, kind of named after its thing, ODM and ODMY, ODMW. And then it's an EXE. The EXE itself is actually that Lua runtime environment. And why that's important or interesting is I mentioned that resource.txt, TXT, is the Lua script. They create for persistence 2 different scheduled tasks. They make them sound like audio drivers because those are kind of a normal thing that people typically see as far as scheduled tasks. but the actual execution command is an exe that's going to be referencing resource.txt or an exe referencing a .lua. That I think in itself is something to trigger off of, because typically when you it's not common for an exe to be referencing text files as a call in a lot of ways, and obviously seeing a Lua file being executed via from an executable as well, know that there's Lua running on your systems. Now Lua is common with like game developers and things like that, so it's not like a completely foreign language, but in a lot of environments, if you are not specifically trying to use Lua or using something that you know is using Lua, then it's probably, you know, skeptical, right? So those are like the two big things that they called out. And I guess I didn't really go into the MCP server specific, like what they really are. MCP servers are kind of like, you know, we just talked about the OpenClaw stuff. It's a way to kind of add agency to basically a chatbot. It's a dedicated server that knows how to talk to these different APIs that you can then communicate with in like plain language, like, hey, what's the ticket status on whatever? And if the MCP server is configured to talk to, say, GitHub and tasks and tickets or something, they will be able to basically run or build the API calls to extract the information that you're requesting, provide that back, and also very human readable text. So it's like almost having a conversation with somebody that works for you to do these tasks. So the same agentic type, you know, flow, but kind of taking advantage of someone in a different way. So what was interesting though is when, you know, the malware itself, right? So this is when I kind of pivoted, because they did have a screenshot. One, in the screenshot, they have the direct IP callouts, the HTTP, always a huge red flag. But they also referenced that the Security Blue Teens blog, which is another vendor group or whatever that puts blogs out there that are, you know, technical and very informative, they actually talk about the SteelC malware itself and some things to look for and how it's written, why it's written. And one of the big callouts that I have seen in the past, and obviously this is a more recent report that's still being done, is the whole geolocation aspect. So it's really important when adversaries are targeting, they typically will try to be geos location specific a lot of times, because they don't want to accidentally hit the wrong targets, because in some ways that adds some level of protection or some level where they don't have to deal with different types of law enforcement and things. It can kind of simplify their life if they target targets they know there's no going to be any fallout for. But either way, they use the website, web resource, whatever you want to call it, ip-api.com. And that essentially will return a JSON data structure of where, what geolocation that public IP address that is seen is at or located. So something else to also pay attention to, that's more the SteelC specific, you know, the end of the payload, so to speak. But either way, just to kind of another example, right, of that kind of supply chain s looking at attacking agentic type things. In this case, it was really just to deliver malware, not necessarily steal unique things. But I still think it's along the same thread. So I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, the developer stuff going to be a hot topic for a while. It was interesting to note that they talked about the, they actually specified it. Let me see if I can get back to that. But they're talking about the MCP kind of, the layout of it lacks some of the checks and balances that some of the other systems that serve up like NPM and such. And we even see them, you know, in those places being able to be compromised in that kind of like sort of supply chain directional attack, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I took away from this, though, as a, hey, I didn't think about this before, and I feel like I should have, but I didn't. But they did talk about how the setup and the process of this, where they kind of did that low and slow, they really tried to establish themselves. They used this to GitHub accounts and all those things. But one thing that I thought that they pointed out, and the article did a great job calling it out, was that the forked content negated to include the original author's name. And that's something that I was sitting here thinking about after I read that, Scott. I mean, you know what? That's a decent check to put in people's minds. Not necessarily absolute by any means, but it's a pretty solid sign to say, hey, maybe this thing's not something I should touch, or maybe not serious, right? I don't know. That one stood out to me. I thought that was interesting. So something I'm going to take away from this one. I'm keeping them in my bag when I'm looking at things like this.
Yeah. And you know, they mentioned that there was the distinct difference in the files was, you know, there was the .txt file, the resources.txt, which if you just look going off file name, sounds like it probably isn't anything important worth looking at. But the fact that it had Lua script in there, I'm pretty sure the script in it. Yeah, if you opened it, you would realize, well, there's code here. Why is it a .txt? Like, what is, you know, like, there's things that if you take, like, you know, a little extra effort and just kind of poke around, curiosity, whatever, I feel like you kind of stumble across this stuff if you're not in a hurry. That's, like, always the catch, right? So.
Yep. That was pretty cool.
Cool. All right, well, what do you got to follow up?
All right, next on the list from my side, I have an article that I have multiple sources here, but we're going to kind of go with the first one. So from Bleeping Computer, it's titled New Click Fix Attack Abuses NSLookup to Retrieve PowerShell Payload via DNS. I also have an article here that is from the Hacker News too, but basically talking on the same item. So Microsoft Threat Intelligence disclosed a new variant of the Click Fix social engineering campaign. This one leverages DNS lookups using Windows NS lookup to stage malware payloads. Kind of expanding on Click Fix as a whole, that technique that really just aims to bypass all the security controls where it can. Instead of simply redirecting users to a download or a malicious script, the version actually instructs victims to run a crafted NSLookup command in the Windows run dialog, which performs a DNS query against an attacker-controlled name server to retrieve the staging and payload instructions. The technique kind of does that, you know, leveraging of a legitimate system tooling and trusted protocols, but this time it's using DNS and NSLookup to continue to show ways to reduce reliance on standard web requests and making that malicious staging traffic blend in even more, just furthermore complicating detections. So it's pretty creative. Once the DNS response is executed, the second stage then downloads and runs a Python reconnaissance script, ultimately dropping and launching the Modelo Rat, which is a Python-based remote access Trojan with persistence mechanisms that are put in place and added to the Windows startup folder. So we have a lot of common behavior nuggets in this, but it's still worth talking about, I think. A little bit of rehash, some of the stuff here, you know, attackers trick users into executing that NSLookup. Then they use DNS as a staging channel. So the NSLookup command points directly to an attacker-controlled DNS server rather than to default resolvers. And the name portion of the response from the DNS query is parsed and executed as the next payload. Basically, it pulls in a whole PowerShell command that then pulls down the payload. Following that DNS lookup, the chain pulls a zip archive from an external server that's set by the attacker. Then it extracts a Python script for reconnaissance and then drops that VBS launcher for the Modelo Rat. Other things we see here too, just to kind of continue to echo, you still see that real heavy lean and focus off living off the land tooling. You know, you see the command line usage on a lookup, the leveraging of DNS to kind of avoid the classic download signatures, the PowerShell commands that are implied. There's a lot of basic stuff there. So this isn't necessarily super novel. When I read it, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. But ultimately, if you're considering some of the really basic things, like some of the behaviors that are common that I know we talk about all the time, Scott, but you consider a few of these things, like looking for those files. In this particular case, it drops LNK files in the startup folder. So identifying those are easy. That's pretty low hanging fruit for telemetry. Seeing when suspicious processes execute those LNK files, also the same. Identifying, like in this case, the the PowerShell command that's ran from the DNS or the DNS lookup response, the PowerShell command that's pulled in that name field that is then executed is just doing a pretty basic invoke web request call, runs an execution bypass, does it hidden, and then just does an invoke web request to pull down that payload. It also has a obfuscated version where it will use carrots to try to space out and obfuscate the actual command. So it has two variants that you can see there. So kind of like 3-4 things that you can look at right away, and you're going to pick up what's happening here downstream, even though they're using a little bit of a novel approach to this, which is kind of cool. It's not necessarily reinventing this whole click fix model, right? A lot of the same activity we've seen in other reports for what was run using this technique follows the same threads. So, I don't know. What'd you think about it, Scott?
No, I mean, it's always interesting because like the clicks, if I can get it out of my mouth, click fix techniques, I mean, they're all really focused around basic delivery and kind of like that social engineering to some aspect. But like you said and mentioned, it's always interesting to see the activity that follows it is the same traditional activity you see with all the traditional malware that's being leveraged so far with click fix type of attacks. And I think that's like the biggest thing, like, you know, people hear about click fix and they kind of like, oh gosh, there's some new way to get in somewhere. It's not really a new way to get in. It's just a new way to start the execution chain or the way to fetch something so that it's still user driven. So no one has to like break in. It's getting basically run from the inside. It's just like any other why you do phishing, right? You want the user to initiate everything so that you've already got past most of the security controls versus trying to break in yourself. But yeah, like I always think it's interesting when people use DNS, because there's a lot of different capabilities that existed. I mean, just like any of those really old protocols, like even if you look at DHCP as an example, there are so many things you could do with it that a lot of people traditionally don't leverage. And I think that's where attackers get really creative, is looking at ways these protocols can be leveraged. And in this case, it's storing commands in the that text record in the DNS record. Now, I'm kind of curious, though, you know, you basically are hosting the DNS server that someone would have to then hit. And so you kind of essentially are burning infrastructure a lot easier, I would say, than traditionally, I guess. I don't know if that statement's really true, but I just feel like you're kind of giving a lot more up by doing things this way, but it's probably a more reliable way to get something to run, especially as vendors try to deal with click fix in general. Right. I'm sure there's no signature for any of the behavior here specifically, right? That a lot of like security products might alert you on today. So I think that's why ClickFix keeps evolving, because there's a lot of very normal things to pick up on from all the different ClickFix campaigns. And so I think that's why they seem to switch or get even more creative. It's more because it's just staying ahead of the security vendor space. But still really cool. I like the use of what they did. The obfuscation, there's always obfuscation in these, right? And then the click fix stuff so that users don't panic when they put something in. Even though I would look at something and be like, that doesn't look good. But that's just speaking from experience, more than likely. But yeah, all the follow-on, like the Hacker News article that you mentioned, they talk about the different types of malwares that follow, and it's like the traditional DLL side loading, traditional, you have CMD launching PowerShell. So you have like the interactive scripting languages launching each other type stuff. Yeah. So all the classic traits of the follow on post exploitation actions that if you're looking for already, it shouldn't matter how they basically get in or trick you to begin with. So,
yeah, I think if anything, it's really, I think the most clever piece out of this was leveraging that process, but really it does kind of obscure it helps remove questions, I think, from an end user's perspective when they see something very basic like NSLookup to example.com and an IP address. It's not
I would imagine that that doesn't necessarily trigger those "what is this thing" as quickly as obfuscated code or a long PowerShell string or something like that, right?
Yeah. So, and like, you think of like the maturity of even a security analyst, you know, the set, like that's typically almost a bias that we have as security folk. Once we see something that we know or are familiar with, our brain kind of stops processing sometimes. So if you're dealing with alerts, for instance, and you got to get through a queue, or you've got like work you're trying to do, so there's like this element of speed and urgency, and you see something like, oh, and let's look up the domain, that what bad could happen with that, right? Like in your head, you're probably, okay, cool, NS lookup's being used, but this is all it can do. And not even thinking about, well, how could DNS be leveraged? And if you saw this whole string of things, and sometimes pipes are shown and unlogging, and sometimes they're not, sometimes they're broken up or they kind of get cut. But if you saw this whole thing, the first question you have to ask is, why is there so much going on and this, right? It's the and piece that you'd have to trick yourself into. Well, what's the other stuff doing? I get this one piece, right? So, yeah.
Nope, very cool. What's last, Scott?
All right, the last one, it's a blog from Forcepoint. I guess they call themselves X Labs. But it's titled Screen Connect Under Attack, Smart Screen Evasion, and RMM Abuse, which is the remote management. We've talked about remote management tools in the past that were heavily used by ransomware authors for a period of time, and they're still being used. It's just not as heavily because now people are paying more attention to the software, I'm assuming, in their environments because of this. But Screen Connect is one of those tools that was being used then and clearly is still being used now. But this attack had some pieces to it that, you know, kind of highlight some of the things we talk about. So it's a good kind of refresh on why we think about things the way we do. So this all started with, basically a phishing email, that had a RAR archive, I believe, in it. And it was supposed to look like the U.S. Social Security Administration, domain. But it had a spelling error, in mismatched recipient fields, subject meant to, it's supposed to stoke curiosity, I guess, because it's e statement instead of statement at SSA.com. But either way, it was something around Social Security, which, you know, I guess is a big topic for some people. You get this RAR, you basically unpack it, and there's it's a .cmd script. And when the script is then run, it checks for administrative privileges, and then it kind of auto elevates itself using PowerShell with the start process run as, which is, a common way to try to elevate yourself when you can do the run as that way. Because even if you have administrative access, I don't know if anyone's experienced this, but you know, you launch PowerShell as yourself and you try to do something that requires administrative access, even if you're part of the admin group, it doesn't let you do it. You have to like then launch it as administrator in order to achieve those things. So I guess that's why that exists. So they do that. They're doing this all with the hidden window style command, right? One of the other things they do is they disable smart screen. So smart screen is a kind of a technology that exists in Windows where it kind of profiles different sites based on, I believe it also does files, like downloaded files. Like if it hasn't seen it before in like the population of where they collect telemetry from, like it's like so rare and new, it might kick off some alarms. Kind of like a new site that could be suspicious, or a file that no one else downloads, but you downloaded it. It kind of triggers for those types of things. One of the first things it does is it makes a registry edit to disable that. And it uses reg, the reg.exe. It's calling that. Also does a task kill to kill Explorer and then restart Explorer. And this is interesting just because it's more of a make sure that the smart screen is truly disabled. Because I guess it relies on Explorer for how it operates. So that's like a guaranteed way to kind of get it to reset. And then it downloads the MSI. The MSI is tied to that Screen Connect piece, right? So it's basically it's a pre-configured So when you set up Screen Connect and you have an account, you kind of put in all the parameters that you want for the configuration, like how it's going to connect back, what options and stuff you want. And then the Screen Connect service will build the MSI for you or give you basically an address based on kind of how you signed up for Screen Connect on how to fetch that MSI. And that's essentially what's going on there, is they're fetching an MSI specifically built for this attack or this purpose. And that's why when it basically executes the MSI, it drops the appropriate config file that it needs to be able to run it correctly and all the additional files, the DLLs and so forth associated with Screen Connect. So, you know, all this stuff we've kind of seen before, right? Sometimes when the config, you know, they try to do some attribution based on looking at the Screen Connect config, which makes sense. But the big thing here was really just looking at the attack chain that got there, right? Like I mentioned before, so you get an email with an attachment. Attachments are always interesting, especially if they're not just plain text documents, so to speak, but it's an archive, which you'll then see, you know, command prompt run that will launch PowerShell, which will then launch MSI. Those three things are hugely questionable. And the MSI is being run where it's actually being passed a URL, which in a lot of ways, attackers have used this to pull in payloads historically for a long time as well. So just looking for MSI running with URLs as part of the command line, it's kind of a good thing to be looking for. And the Screen Connect, the one nice thing about using or attackers using RMMs, or the common remote management tools, is one, they're pretty consistent as far as like the naming goes, sometimes install locations and all that type of stuff. So you could easily build basic triggers for detections to kind of catch the initial, like, hey, this is odd, or this is something we should look at kind of case. So that's worth looking at. Granted, I do believe hashes could be thrown off depending on what file hash you're specifically looking at. The EXEs might change a little bit, but obviously if you're looking at the MSI, that's going to be different when it unpacks because it will have different configs. So I wouldn't rely on the actual MSI payload if you're looking for ILCs for that specifically. Maybe with the campaign itself, it might be good, but in general, I wouldn't focus highly on that. I'd be a little more broad. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like your basic attack for access, but leveraging kind of all the same techniques we always talk about.
So kind of a standout on this one. I'm curious what you think. So we see it once in a while, not as much as I would think, but the attempt to elevate using the kind of that run as approach. What do you think the value of just, you know, kind of broadly searching the space of how often that's seen, you know, given that you have the telemetry enabled, but seeing the run as this part of a command, part of a scripting process, would that stand out, you think, or would that be probably overwhelmingly commonly used?
I don't think that would be overwhelmingly commonly used because I feel like that's not how people elevate naturally. Like, just coming from a personal behavior, when I launch something, I'm like, oh, crap, I need administrator. I'm going to close it out, find it, launch as administrator, right? I'm going to go that route. This doesn't even come across my brain to say, oh, I'm in the wrong thing. Let me do one extra step and leave everything else open behind me just so I can get administrator privileges if that's where I need to be working from that point forward, you know? So I think it'd be a good thing to be paying attention to for sure. I mean, obviously combined with a hidden window, it's even more telling. Like, that would be really suspect. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure people can design applications to do this for whatever reason. In my opinion, it's just poorly implemented. Or they could have a better way that they can achieve whatever they're trying to achieve without doing this. It'd be more like a Band-Aid approach for applications to leverage this for a reason. But yeah, no, it's definitely a good trigger for sure.
Yeah, I've seen it. And as soon as I, and I like that, that at least from my upbringing in the field, right? The scene and be able to pick out some of the artifacts that we're like, hey, I just want to go run that in my environment just to see what shows up, you know, out of like maybe even before an unstructured hunt, right? And that one stood out to me. I'm like, this, I don't think that's going to be super common. I feel like that would be a one you could go grab beyond the stuff that we're commonly talking about, because we don't see this run as that often. So I thought it was worth pointing out. Man.
Yeah, I don't think I've even knew there was a verb argument you can pass to start process, to be honest. Like, it never even occurred to me. Like, I know for different commandlets, sometimes it's really insightful, especially if you know adversaries that use specific commandlets in PowerShell. Just, you know, after you type the commandlet, this hitting the tack button, it'll give you a list of all the different arguments you can pass. Sometimes that's really informative, just to be like, oh, there's these other things you could do to tweak how this runs, and then you can kind of see why adversaries use this or things they potentially could use and aren't using because they don't need to yet, you know. So it's always good to, I guess, know your environment, right? It's just a different part of your environment.
Yep.
So yeah, so I think that pretty much closes out this week's Out of the Woods episode. So I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And so with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 18th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.